From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Whenever I visit a public garden, I see irresistible plants that are new to me and wonder how the horticulturists behind such designs find all these goodies and figure out how to use them so spectacularly. I decided to invite a couple of these experts to the show to find out. But first, this message.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden.
In my quest for a wider plant palette and for ideas on how to put things together with confidence and a bolder hand, I asked Director of Horticulture Louis Bauer of Wave Hill, the world-renowned garden in New York City that's been long praised for its dramatic plantsmanship, to come to the show today and help us. So hi, Louis, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks for asking me.
Yes, it was. Thank you for saying yes, because I need a little help with my plantsmanship over here. So for people who haven't visited Wave Hill, which is a must-stop for any keen gardener, do you want to just give us the like teeny version of why we need to come visit, a little bit about Wave Hill?
Well, it really is a plantsman's garden. You alluded to that.
Yeah.
It is a garden about plants that has grown very organically on the grounds of a very old estate, but it was remade over the past 50 years, starting with Marco Stefano, who was here for a very long time and had a very small budget, and I think that got us started with seeds.
Ah, and so the plants that could be grown from seeds.
Yeah. Are pretty cheap.
Yeah.
If you do it right.
Yeah.
Of course, now we have greenhouses, and they are a little expensive, but we still grow a lot of things from seed for lots of different reasons.
Yeah, and it's right on the Hudson facing the Palisades across the river in New Jersey, so it has dramatic views as well, doesn't it?
It does, and interesting terrain. It's called Wave Hill because the first people who moved here from Manhattan, which is just a few miles away, came here to get away from the urban environment, and viewing the property from the river, it looks like the crest of a wave, sort of lots of up and down,
yeah.
But we're on the crest of that wave, and we look across the vast Hudson to the cliffs across the river,
yeah.
But have lots of microclimates. So not only is it a nice getaway from the city, but we're packed with little microclimates that really increase the kind of variety of things we can grow.
So you have different gardens within the garden and a team of gardeners who I presume some of them care for one area or another most of all or something. And so
that's right.
When it's time to order plants and especially seeds and decide what to grow this coming year, it's not just one person like me in my home garden with the seed catalogs. I can order whatever I want or not. I don't have to discuss it with anybody. It's a dictatorship. but yours must be quite the process to decide kind of what to order. Maybe it's like the voting in states that have caucuses, huh? Does everybody try to convince everybody else what we're going to grow, or how does it work?
I'll tell you how it works, and this may surprise you. I'm a gentle overlord when it comes to ordering the seeds. The real squabbles come when the seeds germinate and we need space to grow them on.
Ah.
So it's easy to have a very long list of things you want to grow. It's another thing to find space when they're all coming up. So I tend to be pretty generous when people are ordering 20 or 30 different kinds of things to try. And if we were only growing three of each, it would be easy, but
yeah.
Obviously we have a big garden and sometimes we need 40 or 70 or 100 of some things, and that makes sense to grow from seed when you need so many, but sometimes we're growing things from seed just to try out half a dozen plants.
Right.
And that's where the real juggling comes.
Right.
Also, the price of seeds doesn't tend to add up quite so fast as nursery plants. So
that's for
so
sure.
It is easy to overindulge.
Yeah.
And So honestly, the squabbling comes for space in the greenhouse
at the end
of March and April.
Okay. So because you shared with me the spreadsheet that you all made, which was color-coded and all kinds of organized and everything.
Everybody's initials.
Yeah. Who ordered what and so forth and where it came from. And so it was quite a list. It sounds like you guys start a lot of things from seed. Is that kind of your preference, or I mean, besides the economics of it, is that something you love to do?
I started at Wave Hill as manager of the tropical house.
Ah.
So growing things from cuttings was my thing.
Oh, okay.
And there are a few things that we still put in the tropical house to germinate. Even though most things germinate at about the same temperature, there are a few things that like the extra warmth in the tropical house. But I always appreciated some of the reasons to grow from seed, and that was the subtle variation that you get from growing some kinds of things from seed. And we can talk about that later. But some of the people who joined our team in the past 10 years had a great reputation as seed growers.
I see.
And they, I think, increased the number of things that we grew from seed in the past 15 years. There are some groups that have always been grown from seed, especially alpines and natives, but we expanded that in the last 10 years.
Okay, so the fight for greenhouse space is going to be even wilder than ever.
So, it is.
Yeah. So your personal eye, I think you, if I remember correctly, your educational background, I think there may have been studying of architecture.
That's right.
And I seem to also recall maybe when around the time we first met, I almost feel like you had a stint working with floral design, maybe.
Floral design and graphics.
Yep. Even. So a lot of like influences. So when Louis Bauer looks at catalogs, what are you looking for to sort of, you know, wade through, because there's a lot out there. What are you looking for? Like kind of what types of plants or categories of plants or what catches your eye?
Well, it's so many things, and it's not easy to say what it is exactly. And this is going to sound contradictory, but partly it helps to know what I can get from nurseries.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm going to have to grow from seed.
I see. So necessity is one thing, okay.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I want yellow or blue violas, I know I can get them at the local nursery. And if I want marigolds or those kinds of things, that's kind of a long list.
Commodity
but, you know, I've
items.
Been around,
more,
so I know
yeah.
what people
yeah,
are
yeah.
going to have for sale.
Yeah.
But some of the things that are most important here, and I'm thinking of them at this time of year, is the early spring things that we put on display while the weather is still pretty cold. We grow a lot of Western wildflowers and display them in the palm house with South African bulbs. And like violas and calendulas, there's another dozen things that we grow because we have to grow them from seed because there aren't many people out there who want these things that are really the early cool season things.
Right. So the nurseries in New York City area aren't doing a big business in early
Nasturtium
April, probably. Okay.
So some of the Western wildflowers are Nemesia and Heliophila and Calceolaria and Mimulus and Felicia, pretty little wildflowers that in the West grow in the cool weather. Same as the violas that everybody likes in the spring.
Right.
So we have to grow all of those from seed. We can't buy them.
I see. Okay. So do you look in the catalogs, do you have like a passion for, is it something new? Is it something old? Like, you know, do you have any like niches that always attract your attention?
Lately, it's more often things that are old.
Okay. So?
Species hostas. Species daylilies. You would think that if with 15,000 something daylilies and maybe even more hostas, that who would in their right mind would bother to grow them from seed? But believe it or not, I'm counterintuitively that I'm interested. we've been growing some Hemera calisthenbergii, one of the species daylilies, and what's wonderful about them is that they're really simple and graceful. and they have a slight variation in color. Some are pale yellow, and some are really gold, and some are almost melon-colored, and that is just the natural variation. And especially in places like the wild garden, it just makes them look like they belong there in the wild garden part of Wave Hill.
And so how long does it take from seed to grow that? It's a daylily, yes?
About two years. The first year they get a little longer growing season because we're growing them in a protected place. And some of them have bloomed in the second year.
Oh, so it's an investment of time.
But not a huge investment. We've grown lilies from seed, too, and they take 3 or 4.
That daylily, how is it big? Is it small? What's it like?
Thunbergii has a nice tall stem, but not a very big flower. Like I said, I think that what's wonderful about it is its gracefulness. It kind of bobs in the air, and it doesn't have a big mushy ending when it's faded. It kind of drops off on its own. It is simple and graceful. I don't know. I'm repeating myself.
No, that's okay. Was it something that used to be available more, or is it? Do you know what I mean? Is it something old, or?
I think probably 100 years ago it was available.
Okay.
But now that there are 15,000 named ones, the nurserymen trip over themselves trying to have the newest one that no one has. And I don't know. Maybe someday the market will change a little, and there will be a resurgence of interest in simpler things.
Mm.
Well, I think that's really what it is.
And you've told me in the past that you kind of like simple and old-fashioned things, like things that, you know, like you just were saying, you know, as opposed to the 15,000 or 50,000 or whatever that are out there that are all new, perfect, whatever, improved, the latest
big
thing.
Big fat ruffly.
Yeah. I saw on the list, on the spreadsheet, some sort of things that I think of as kind of old-fashioned perennials, some dianthus, for instance, some digitalis. Can we talk about those a little bit? I mean, those to me feel like from an English garden a little bit, and I don't mean to say like you're copying English gardens. I don't mean that at all.
But you're right. They were popular in English gardens, and some of them work well in our gardens too. And there certainly is a place for plants that have been selected forms because they perform better in our weather.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the straight species are just wonderful, and the reason that nursery businesses have moved away from them is that in some ways a lot of the nurseries have become big business, and the only way they can sort of protect their rights over merchandise is to have a named form that's trademarked or something.
Right.
And so they have a hard time marketing the simple, straight, old-fashioned things. There's no marketing mechanism behind it, so it doesn't get attention to grab the consumer's attention.
So with something, so like the little, like the dianthus, for instance, I think of those as something I expect to see at Wave Hill, not like masses everywhere or whatever, but
little patches at the front of the bed.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. At Wave Hill, the plants aren't obedient to stay within the confines of the bed. They're happy to cascade over, and that's part of it's sort of that softness against the hardness of the path you're walking on or something.
That's true in most places, but as you said at the beginning, we have a number of different gardens that make up our Wave Hills gardens, and how we manage those gardens differ a little from area to area, but we definitely have more places where they creep over the edges, and we like that, especially as the season goes on, to get a little looser.
Yeah. Another thing I saw, quite a number of different varieties were Oryngium on your list. Oryngium. Is there some Oryngium obsession going on at Wave Hill at the moment?
I think maybe Harnick in the flower garden is a little Oryngium obsessed.
Okay.
But Jalene tries to keep up with him in the wild garden.
And you're referring to two of your gardeners, two of your team.
Yes, the two of the team.
Yeah.
Gardening can be competitive too, you know.
So what do you think about Oryngium? Because, you know, it's more and more people that I know are growing it again. And I remember a couple decades ago, we all were excited about maybe one or two that were out there. But it seems like there are more.
There are more, and not just from seed, because there are a few new species that are available if you look at some of the specialty seed catalogs, but there are also some new selections that are a little bluer, or there's even one with gold foliage.
Oh my goodness, you're kidding me.
But
that must be crazy.
It's a tough one to grow. But in the wild garden especially, we kind of stick to straight species, and so I think Burgatti might be the one species you saw on the list that hasn't been around for a while, and suddenly it's on seed list. So we have to try it.
So people who don't know, the Eryngiums are sometimes called to sea hollies, I think. Is that the common name? Yeah, and then there's that silvery one called Rattlesnake Master that's not called a sea holly, but I think that's Yuccafolium, Eryngium Yuccafolium, which I love as well.
Native.
Yeah, and so you
the
just...
Native ones?
Yeah.
Biennial one with Miss Wilmot's Ghost.
Miss Wilmot's Ghost, which used to be a thing in English gardens.
Right.
You know, I remember that was a sort of a signature plant. Another sort of English garden thing I had never seen it in an American garden, but years ago I saw it in England, that I saw on your list was Centranthus rubra, I think, the Jupiter's beard, but you didn't order a pink flowered variety.
No, a white one.
Uh-huh.
And that has for decades been a plant that was in between the greenhouses that became the herb garden and dry garden. These were old greenhouse foundations that became little garden rooms.
Uh-huh.
And they had spaces between them that were kind of, well, anyway, in between spaces.
Uh-huh.
And it's a tough old-fashioned perennial that comes in a kind of pale brick color. But there's a white form, which is very nice. And I think in the process of doing some renovations, we lost the clumps that were there and are looking to get them back.
Okay. So whatever people are growing, one of the putting everything together is the hardest part. It's one thing to say, I got this, and I got this, and I got this. And one of the ways that we put things together is with what we, you know, kind of semi-jokingly call filler plants, right? But, you know, plants that make... that help things come together. And do you have some of those that you're kind of excited about or using more or whatever on your list this year?
I have two that are kind of on the top of my list, and
they're
things that especially help to fill in dry shade.
Okay.
Erigeron pulchellus.
Oh.
Which is fleabane.
Fleabane,
Doesn't have a very appealing common name, but it's a wonderful plant on tough tree root zones.
And is this a version with like a different size flower or something? Is that why it's a name selection?
Actually, its flower is kind of simple. What's nice about it is its leaf. It has a broader, sort of thicker textured leaf.
But it's like a tiny little daisy-ish looking thing.
Its flower is a little daisy and kind of simple, and I'd be okay if it didn't bloom at all.
Oh,
because
that's interesting.
It looks like a velvety bergonia.
Oh, okay.
Its leaf is that sort of thick and flattened against the ground. And I've been trying it in a couple of places combined with some of the carex that tolerate dry places. Like
some of the sedges. Oh, so that's a native one, the Carex apalachica.
Yes. So it's this fine textured little tuft of, looks like grass, and a flat velvety leaf. So the combination of textures is wonderful and fill up places where I can't get very many different things to grow, but those two are very happy.
Huh.
And it makes a segue into the part of the woodland or tree underplanting where I can grow some interesting things. So they're definitely fillers for spots like that.
For that transition-y kind of area, huh?
Exactly.
Huh.
In our native plant garden, there are a couple of other carexes like gray eye that has an interesting little seed head. So we've been growing a number of carexes. It's probably not news. Carexes have so many hundreds of species that we barely know that fill all sorts of niches in the garden and pull things together.
And it's really becoming more of an it plant in the sense of it was almost unknown not so long ago other than... you know, a sedge here or there, you know, in a native setting. but
or some Asian one with gold stripes.
right.
Those gaudy ones.
Yeah, we don't want
But we've
those.
Been growing. We've been growing some from seed, and in our woodland where we have trouble with some invasives filling up the empty space, getting carexes to grow in some of those in-between places helps to knit things together and keep the garlic cress or the stilt grass from getting a foothold.
The naughty beasts.
Exactly.
Yes. So with pots, do you have kind of is there like a color theme in each area, or is there a, I don't mean to make it sound formulaic, but how do you, so we talked about how the garden faces out to the Hudson River, and
right.
part of the view is through a beautiful old pergola structure, and there are frequently pots arranged there very artfully. Is there like a, this year we're doing everything there in pink and, you know, silver and blue, or, you know, do you know what I mean?
Yep.
There is,
yes,
okay.
And in fact, the gardeners each there are several areas where things are very thoughtfully color schemed.
Okay.
The entrance to the greenhouses and the center of the flower garden
right.
are two places where there are groups of pots. The pergola that you mentioned, which kind of frames the view out to the Hudson.
Okay.
And the terrace where the cafe refreshments are served and people sit there for a while. All of those areas, the gardeners put a lot of thought into how the color combinations will work together. And so each year there is a little shift in silver and blue with touches of gold, or reds and purples and fuchsia, or and sometimes it's more than one scheme. It's one scheme in the spring, and then when we change over to the hot season plantings, it's a different scheme.
Hmm.
So yeah, there are. Jen likes to make a little color board with clipping, you know, a sort of pasted on a board. Her little menu of plants going out. Other people just keep a list of the names and they picture them in their head.
Uh-huh.
So everybody has their own way.
Okay. So that was a good tip, though, that in areas where you're sort of announcing that you're arriving at something, like the entrance to the to the conservatories or the flower garden, or looking across to, you know, being drawn to the pergola, that it's important to have it more planned and more together. So that's a good tip. We just have a couple minutes, and I just want to ask you sort of rapid fire signature. If I said, I can't imagine Wave Hill without ... Are there sort of signature plants that you feel like are synonymous with Wave Hill?
Without woad in the wild garden.
Okay, woad.
It's that huge cloud of chartreusey yellow flowers that is a plant that was used to make dye, indigo dye.
Mm-hmm.
In the flower garden, I would say I can't imagine the flower garden without larkspur and poppies.
Yes.
I can't imagine our little native elliptical garden without zizia, which is golden Alexander's.
Mm-hmm.
Each garden, I guess, deserves its own can't live without. Don't
interesting. Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, I completely agree. So is the woad, I'm going to guess from the depths of my old rattled brain, Isatis?
Yes.
Tinctoria. Isatis tinctoria, right?
Yeah. You got it.
It's a dye, right. With a dyer's woad. Yeah, yeah. Oh, those are good ones. Those are good ones. And the you just said larkspur, didn't you, in the flower garden?
Yes.
And does that sow itself every year, or do you have to redo it?
It sows itself. But every once in a while, we try to introduce. We have from time to time introduced a new shade of larkspur. We also conscientiously decide which ones to save for self-seeding, so that there are just a few pink ones and mostly blue.
I see. So you edit a little.
There's also a kind of smoky gray blue one that we tried to get going and sometimes have to add a few seeds because it seems to shrink.
Well, Louis Bauer, I love all of these ideas, and I'm going to give, of course, with the transcript, visiting information and everything else about how people can find Wave Hill. So thank you so much for making the time and sharing the ideas.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden.
Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at Facebook or Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.